Stay tuned for Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah, featuring two film critics with distinctly different tastes in movies, Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net. He thinks her tastes are shallow. She thinks his are pretentious. Listen in as they discuss and debate new releases and other film-related topics. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome. Thanks for joining us. I'm Charlie Jewell.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
And coming up on this edition of the Cinema Clash, Nat Turner leads a slave rebellion in the antebellum South in Nate Parker's epic drama, The Birth of a Nation.
Emily Blunt plays a drunk and bitter divorcee who thinks she may have witnessed or even committed a crime in The Girl on the Train.
And a historian played by Rachel Weisz must prove the Holocaust actually happened when a denier sues her for libel in denial.
Gee, I wonder who wins that case.
Hey, I didn't see it, so you're going to have to somehow tell me without spoiling it.
That's right. Fair enough.
So how you doing?
I'm doing okay. How about you?
It's fall outside.
It is.
I'm not sweating. I don't even have the air conditioner on. I don't have the heater on. This is the best month of the year.
It's beautiful, but we don't have a hurricane to contend with. So hopefully all those folks out in Florida and Georgia and North Carolina are battening down the hatches and doing okay.
I hear a lot of people are without power, which is a Cinema Clash problem.
Yes, it would be.
All right, let's dive right into one of the major awards contenders this early in the year. It was called an awards contender because it won both huge awards at January Sundance Film Festival. It won the Audience Award, so the people loved it, and it won the Grand Jury Award, so the jury made of Nate Parker's fellow filmmakers loved it the most as well, and it came out at the same time as hashtag OscarsSoWhite, and it's about a slave rebellion in the South, so... Oh, it had Oscar buzz all over it, then it ran into a buzzsaw, mm-hmm. which we'll talk about, and now that it's out and everybody's seen it, all right, no, it's not Best Picture.
No.
But what was your immediate gut reaction?
Well, I hate being told that we're supposed to find something so incredibly powerful and that we're supposed to assume that it's Oscar-worthy, and it's good, but I felt my visceral reaction was just like, it's a good movie, but I feel like I've seen it before in 12 Years a Slave and Django Unchained. And I just think there have been as good, if not better, movies on the topic. And I don't feel that this one necessarily transcends the rest.
12 Years a Slave was a masterpiece. Mm-hmm. I really loved that movie. And Django Unchained was a fantasy. It was funny. And I just loved seeing the slave kill Whitey. It was great. And in this one, the trailer is all about revenge. Him running with knives and pitchforks. And actually, no, that's a lie. 7/8 of this movie is everything but the rebellion. It's how you get so mad that you rebel. It's a lot of torture porn. Whippings, rapes, teeth knocked out with chisels. It's brutal. It might be more brutal than 12 Years a Slave, but it's not as fine as that movie.
It isn't. And that last half hour is brutal, but everything leading up to it is much easier to swallow. It's easier to watch. And I was with them. I was into the story.
You found that easy to watch?
Not easy to watch, but I mean, but the characters were interesting to me and the story was interesting. And there is a sweet romance that is part of that that story between the Nat Turner character and this other slave woman that he encourages his master to buy. And then he sort of love at first sight and he marries her. It's a sweet story. So I liked that sort of subplot within this movie. And once it got brutal, I turned away and I just, you know, it's a difficult watch, and I'm not sure that it's a watch that many people are going to seek out. So I don't know. What do you think?
Well, when I saw 12 Years a Slave, I recognized it for what it was, a beautiful piece of amazing filmmaking, mm-hmm. and then I said, I'll never watch it again.
Exactly. I said the same
thing. I watched it
one
time, mm-hmm. and I have no appetite to ever see it again. I'll just remember it forever,
yes.
And it's so stomach-churning. Same with Birth of a Nation. I'm glad I watched it. Mm-hmm. I gave it its 3 stars. I'm mm-hmm. never going to watch it again. Even though it's, I think it's an easier watch than 12 Years. And I was so happy. I was thankful when he picked up the axe and started chasing slave owners. And like, it's about time. Get her done, Nat.
Yeah, I did expect it to be more about the rebellion. And that is such a, it's almost a, it's a final act of this movie. And I'm not sure that the character development had gotten where it needed to be for me to really fully support what the slaves were doing in slaughtering the masters. That it's Armie Hammer plays the master Turner.
Samuel Turner.
And his character, I mean, it was a very interesting take that you see how he grew up with Nat Turner, and that they were sort of childhood playmates. But then in the end, because of the roles that they're prescribed, that they're born into, you know, Nat's a slave and Samuel is a master, and he ends up, you know, falling on the side of doing what masters do. And so it's, but he has a, you feel like there's a conscience brewing just below the surface with Samuel. And so the turn that the movie takes, I'm not sure that the character development within the movie justifies what happens at the end.
Actually, I think that was Nate Parker's most effective writing. He shrewdly gave Samuel Turner a full character arc. When they're children, they play hide-and-seek together and they're friends. When they're late teens and 20s and Samuel's not yet the master, they're kind of bros. Mm-hmm. They share the front bench of the buggy. Samuel protects Nat when he's getting whipped in the street by another guy. And then he becomes master of the house and realizes, oh man, finances are due. I'm in debt. I'm going to start peddling Nat out to make some money. And he becomes an alcoholic and a typical slave owner. I really thought that was an effective character arc.
Mm-hmm. It was getting there. So I do feel like that character arc was really good. I'm just not sure that I bought into the final solution of what happened in that movie. But yeah, again, I agree. It's one of those ones, just like 12 Years a Slave, where I knew I had to see it. And I go, okay, I don't have to see it again. But unlike with 12 Years a Slave, I knew immediately that it should win the Oscar. There was just no doubt in my mind. This one, there's plenty of doubt and plenty of room for other movies to take over in the Oscar race.
Well, Parker did not make Nat Turner a hero. He wasn't born and then just started doing these amazing things and saved everybody. He's conflicted. He is torn apart in two. He's a rare for a slave child. He sounds out letters and he teaches himself to read. And so they give him the Bible. He said, you know what? You learn this book, you'll be okay. You just learn this book. So he does. He learns the entire Bible and he's able to preach to his fellow man. And it's kind of this fire and brimstone preaching. And Samuel Turner says, I'm going to make some money off of this. We're going to go to all these surrounding plantations, and there's some consternation, maybe some threat of rebellion, because it's hard times. They're in a drought. The slaves are starving. They're not feeding them. And he's like, all right, you pacify the slaves. You preach to them. And you can see him getting into it. Mm-hmm. And they're kind of baiting him. They're coaching him with the select Bible verses. And this is a tactic Parker employs, because he shows you not all plantations come in the same shape and size and attitude. So right. This is how we go. So we go around and we see the other slaves and how bad they have it.
Yeah.
Oh, my Lord.
That's right. It could have been so much worse. But going back to Nate Parker, and this is his movie. I mean, he is the director and I think the writer and the lead actor. And he's very impressive as the lead actor, and I would not be surprised and would be probably okay at this point in time to see him certainly in the running for the lead actor, although he would never win because of the elephant in the room.
So we mentioned the film ran into a buzzsaw, and when I say the film, I mean Nate Parker ran into a buzzsaw. In 1999, in Penn State, he was charged with rape along with his co-writer. He was acquitted. His co-writer was convicted, which was later overturned on appeal. And the woman in question, the accuser, later committed suicide in 2012. And when this all came out, he did not handle it very well. Mm-hmm. Poor public relations, poor explanations. He never apologized. And he said a really bad sentence. I was never taught the concept of consent in sex. He's in trouble.
Yes, he is in trouble and deservedly so, because it's impossible to watch this movie knowing that backstory and not see a tremendous irony in it, because he is trying very hard in this movie to anger the viewers with the rape scenes and with the degradation of the female characters, and to know what he was accused of, it does color your perception, and there's just no way around it. And I just don't think he can separate the two. It's as try as you might to say, well, there's art and there's reality, and you need to separate the person from the art. In this particular case, because of the material involved, I don't think you can.
Not many people are going to remember everything about this movie come voting time, because it was released in early October. And I think they're going to remember the really strong imagery the most. Look at the movie poster. It's an American flag, but the red stripes are slaves raising pitchforks and screaming. That's probably the best movie poster I've seen in years. It's really good. And the movie title, The Birth of a Nation. He stole it from a racist Ku Klux Klan praising 1915 D.W. Griffith film, The Birth of a Nation, widely credited as the first major feature film of all time, and he stole it, and it's wonder, what a brilliant move. It's a good idea, and I think a lot of people are going to remember that.
It's brilliant, but it's also a little confusing, because people who aren't aware of what the original was, all they know is that, is this a remake? And so anyone who might think that it's a remake of that 1915 Klan movie are in for a huge surprise. And so I don't know if stealing that title was the most effective move. I understand why he did it, but I think it's going to cause just as much confusion as it does a...
It will in the public, but not in Oscar voters.
No, not in Oscar voters. But again, I do think that his personal life is going to
he's done.
Cast a shadow over anything that the Academy might otherwise have brought to bear with any kind of Oscar contention.
You know, I want to talk about a little bit how it looks. There's a couple shots of the cotton field. It's very slow, panoramic. That cotton field goes on forever, and it's gorgeous shot.
It is gorgeous.
And at the same time, I was thinking about, you know who picks that cotton? You know how much blood and sweat and torture is in that beautiful field right now? It's like, I don't know, it got me thinking about like this duality of the cotton field. And it's such an effective move. The cinematographer's Elliot Davis, he did The Iron Lady, if you remember Meryl Streep as Maggie Thatcher.
Yeah, I didn't like that movie.
You didn't like that?
No, I thought it was very boring.
So it's actually not as good looking as 12 Years a Slave. All right, I'm tired of comparing it to 12 Years a Slave. It's not as good as 12 Years a Slave in anything in any way, but it's still at parts gorgeous to look at.
Yeah.
But it was shot on indie money. Like, this is an indie film. Fox Searchlight bought it for this record amount, like $17.5 million. But yeah, it's so gorgeous, but it was on an indie budget. There's no studio money behind this.
Yeah, that's impressive.
And by the way, Southampton, Virginia, where this takes place, it was filmed in Savannah. So when you see all the oak trees with the Spanish moss hanging down, there's no Spanish moss in Southampton, Virginia. So that's I'm calling you out on that one, Nate.
Oh, sorry. Well, I thought it was interesting just to give a little shout out to Armie Hammer. I think he did a really good job. And it's just such a departure for him. I really liked him in Man from U.N.C.L.E., where he was took on a much more entertaining role. But I thought that this definitely showed him to have some interesting range as well.
He was great in Man from U.N.C.L.E. And the best thing they did to his character, they gave him bad teeth. all the slaves actually have, most of them have good teeth, especially the women. But Armie Hammer has like probably teeth you would see in the 19th century. And I mean, he had them all, which is probably not true, but... Man, his teeth were looking really bad, and I was like, ooh, good move.
Oh, okay, hadn't noticed that. I'll have to check it out.
All right, break. Our next film is an adaptation, think Gone Girl, of a very popular novel that people have been reading for the last 2 years. It's only been out 2 years. It's maybe a year and a half even. It's so new that the book was published and on bookstore shelves the same week the adapter submitted her screenplay adaptation of it to the studio, to DreamWorks. That's how much they knew this book was going to take off. But I call it Gone Girl Light. It's called The Girl on the Train. And take us away.
Yeah, I read Gone Girl and The Girl on the Train, and they feel very similar. I mean, there's just no way that the two will not be compared. And it's one of those movies you can't give away too much of the plot, because you really have to sort of just let it unfold. But basically, you've got this bitter divorcee, Rachel, and she's an alcoholic, and she tortures herself by taking the train every day from into Manhattan on the Metro North line from the suburbs.
Bitter is an understatement.
And she watches, you know, we all look out the window as the train's going by and you think about the people who live in these houses. Well, she's going by her old neighborhood and she likes to sort of take a look at her old house where her ex-husband now lives with the woman that he cheated on her with, and they have a baby. So they're living the life that she always really wanted to be living in that house. And then two doors down, you have this beautiful couple and who are always seemingly out on their balcony half naked. And there are and she makes up a backstory for them and idealizes their relationship. And then one day the train's going by and she sees the woman kissing some other guy that's not the husband.
Heavens.
And, oh, my God. And she flips out and she's drunk and she gets off the train. And then the next morning she wakes up, she's bloodied and confused. And the question becomes, and we find out that that woman who had been on the balcony is missing. And so then really the way the movie unfolds is, what did she, did Rachel possibly do this woman harm? Did she know what happened to the woman? And therefore, a mystery unfolds from that point on.
So it's a blackout mystery. It's really a whodunit. And it's actually on the Agatha Christie end of things, just because the way it plays with you. All right, we're going to make this person suspicious now, so you think he did it. Then 5 minutes from now, this person's suspicious, so you think he did it or she did it. And then it's just until the end, then the big reveal.
Yeah.
So the girl on the train introduces the concept of the unreliable narrator. We have three protagonists. Rachel's the main one, Emily Blunt, and she talks to us. You can tell us this is from a novel because she talks to us a lot in monologue in her head. And she, we don't know if she's telling us the truth because she is plastered. This woman is drunk. The second woman, the one she always sees on the balcony, Megan, played by Haley Bennett. She is an unreliable narrator because she tells us, as she's telling her shrink, I'm a liar. I lie to myself, I lie to my husband, I'm lying to you, and I'm a liar, so we can't trust anything she says. The third protagonist, Anna, the new wife, the mistress turned new wife, she's played by Rebecca Ferguson. I can't trust her either, because, you know, she's got her own motivations. She's a brand new mother, she's very protective, and she's going to act on the interest of her child and her new house and her new husband. So you can't trust anybody, which is awesome. Yeah. I really like that. I like feeling off balance. Director Tate Taylor, thank you for dribbling out pieces of information. Because you launched in saying she rides on the train and she sees her old house. For the first half hour, we do not know she used to live on that street. We don't have a clue. She's talking about Balcony Girl. And only later does she happen to mention, oh, I used to live over there. And that's my husband. I can see through the window. It's like, oh, you tricky, tricky Tate Taylor, you.
Spoiler alert, sorry. Yeah, no, it's effective. It's pretty faithful. Again, it's been about 2 years since I read the book when it first came out. It was a book club selection, and everyone was reading it. And I remember thoroughly enjoying the book. I remember not particularly liking the way it ended. And I didn't particularly like the way it ended in the movie because it's very faithful to the book. So those who have seen the book or who have read the book will know exactly what happened. Everyone else might actually be okay with it if they're just kind of going along for this ride. But the performances are solid. Emily Blunt, they did change the locale for the movie from London to New York in order to shoot it in the U.S.
Make more money.
And make more money. Ironically, Emily Blunt retains her normal British accent, which is never really explained in the movie.
They don't talk about it, but yeah, no. She just seems to be a British chicken in America.
But she's very good, and she has just proven herself to be really just an excellent actress. And all three of the women in this movie are really, really good.
My favorite, by a long shot, who circles around and just out-acts the rest of the cast, hands down, is Haley Bennett as Megan. And we just saw her 3 weeks ago as the woman in The Magnificent Seven. That was her.
Oh, wow. I did not even make that connection. She looks very different.
So everyone knows, if you've seen The Magnificent Seven and I say the woman, you know who I'm talking about. Because there was the woman. And as Megan, she is really good. She has a tearful backstory, which she exposes over time, and the way she manipulates her shrink, the way she fights with her husband, she's very good.
She is. She's very manipulative.
She's going to make my supporting actress list.
I can see that. Although, and it's just for fair warning for anyone thinking of taking kids to see this movie.
No.
It is R.
It is R.
It's cheap R, but there is a lot of sex that goes on that I don't recall really there being that much
like,
in the book.
It's basic cable sex.
It is basic cable sex, but it was like, oh my gosh, they all looked alike. So it was really hard sometimes. You're like, okay, who's going at it with who? And that's intentional that there's some a couple of the characters look very similar. And so it was just a bit of surprise for me because I just don't recall that being as big a part in the book.
Yeah, a lot of people online are saying this is the perils of pretty people.
Yes, I think so. And yeah, I mean, as we mentioned, I mean, Megan's character, it's like, really, do people really go and stand out on their balconies half naked?
She loves her upper balcony in the rear of her house and just stretching.
When you're facing train tracks, do you really walk outside and stretch in your underwear all the time?
She's in her young 20s, so maybe she's into that.
Maybe.
The way it looks, now this is weird. The cinematographer, her name is Charlotte Bruce Christensen. She did Far From the Madding Crowd, a very wide-open film, open air, golden sunshine on fields of hay, and this is claustrophobic as hell, and it's gray, you're stuck in a train, and you're in extreme close-ups. I saw Emily Blunt and Haley Bennett's like pore structure frequently, and it's so different from Far From the Madding Crowd. You were like, pull back already. I'm tired of being up her nose.
It was very tight in how it was shot, and I think that was to sort of try and raise the drama and the tension. So I think it was effective for what they were going for. And again, it felt, I think Gone Girl is better. Gone Girl to me, just sort of like we talk about how 12 Years a Slave was better than The Birth of a Nation. Gone Girl for me was better than The Girl on the Train. But it doesn't mean you can't see both or enjoy both. If you like the genre, if you like the books, then chances are you're still going to like this movie.
Gone Girl was more cunning. It was more shocking. My eyes, you know, bulged out of my head at Gone Girl because I didn't read that book either. And I was shocked. I couldn't believe. And Rosamund Pike blew it out of the water.
I thought Ben Affleck did an excellent job too in that one.
So yeah, everything in The Girl on the Train is third tier compared to that. It doesn't hit. It lacks the weight.
Right. No, I agree. And so it's, if you're comparing them straight up, then Gone Girl wins. But if you're just comparing The Girl on the Train to a lot of the other movies that have been out in recent months, it's a solid movie. It's a solid crime drama.
It's a solid crime drama, but it's an average movie.
It's average, yeah.
All right, our third film, Denial, courtroom drama, I assume, because Rachel Weisz is in the courtroom saying, the Holocaust happened, yo.
Yeah, it's a courtroom drama. Rachel Weisz, who's been in everything this year, it seems, stars as Deborah Lipstadt, who is this Emory University professor out of Atlanta and American historian, who ends up getting sued by this guy, David Irving, who is a Holocaust denier, because Lipstadt had written a book in which she basically calls out Irving, calls him a liar, saying, you know, how can you deny the Holocaust that existed? It's fact. And you're an idiot. And so Irving sues her for libel in the British courts.
Which you can do. Their laws,
are wackadoodle because the burden of proof falls to the defense in the British courts. And so it is up to Deborah Lipstadt and her legal team to prove that that Irving is a liar, and to prove that she did not libel him. And so it's all very twisted. Irving plays he serves as his own lawyer, which, you know, we know how that usually goes.
Good idea. We should all do it.
Yeah. So it's Rachel Weisz is good, but compared to her other performances this year and things like The Light Between Oceans, and I've heard she's really good in the really weird lobster movie.
Well, we saw her also.
And we saw her in Complete Unknown, where she really transforms herself throughout that movie. And so to me, having seen her in so many other things this year, I felt this performance was kind of flat. But I think other people who've seen Denial and haven't seen Rachel Weisz in a thousand other things this year might not feel quite that way.
Well, all she did in The Light Between Oceans was cry.
but she was a very powerful presence on the screen, and I just didn't feel first of all, you can't have, it's really hard to have a lot of courtroom drama about a libel case. It's just difficult. And so
it's like chess.
They try to really pull the emotion out of, I mean, this guy tried saying that Auschwitz didn't actually have gas chambers, that they were used for storage and for disinfection and things like that.
Did he not watch Son of Saul?
I guess he did not watch Son of Saul, because this movie is, I think the case was tried in the mid-1990s, like in 1996. And the fact, it's a fascinating story, so I really wish the movie had been better. There are some really good performances. Oh, Tom Wilkinson is in it. He plays the barrister who really handles most of the cross-examination in this trial. And Tom Wilkinson's just always good.
Well, who plays the denier?
So the denier is, let me remember what he was good. What was his name?
Is it Timothy Spall? He is fantastic. Did you see Mr. Turner like 2 years ago? That man should have won an Oscar.
Yeah, so Timothy Spall was he's very good. He's very creepy, and you just kind of want to reach through the screen and strangle him and just be like, how in the world do you get this far? And, you know, it's an interesting movie for the times, because you really get this sense that, you know, how can people buy into an argument when somebody is obviously twisting facts around and is making stuff up, and people are giving them the benefit of the doubt. And it's like, there is no benefit of the doubt here. To say that the Holocaust didn't happen, it's like, you know, it's just flat out wrong. And so it's very interesting to see how people can come to someone's defense. It's scary to see how people could buy into this guy's argument and support him in his legal battles against Lipstadt.
Well, it does sound intriguing, but I'm not racing to the theaters to see it based on that description.
Well, I mean, it's a bit slow in the pacing and a bit lacking in drama, but it is a very interesting story. So I think historians, political science majors, law schools. I think
those, I was a political science major.
There you go. But then you might still get something out of it. I think it's an interesting case study for law students, perhaps, to watch. But it is a courtroom drama at its core. I equate it to sort of like an Aaron Brockovich meets the Holocaust, but Aaron Brockovich was better, is a better movie. Mm. It was, you know, it was just a more of a full picture. The whole movie was just better. But it's that kind of thing. It's, you know, the one woman's battle against, this other, you know, this guy trying to bring her down. And it's just, it's okay, but it's not great at all.
Well, there's a wide release we're not covering this week because we didn't see it because it looks awful. It's called Middle School. And there's like a colon, the worst years of my life or something.
I think it's okay that we skipped middle school.
Yeah, we're not talking about middle school. So if you tuned in from middle school, well, come on, you should know better.
That's right. And, you know, for those of us, since we were not around last week to do our podcast, then Deepwater Horizon is just a good, solid action movie to go see if people are interested in that one.
Meh.
It's, you know.
Meh.
It's meh, but again, it's just a different style of movie that's out there right now.
What was the other one? There was another big one last week.
There was another big one we saw, yeah.
Oh, Miss Peregrine's
You saw that one.
Home for Peculiar Children, Tim Burton. There's a splash of Beetlejuice, a splash of Big Fish, but it lacks the bite of Beetlejuice. It's okay. It's middle ground Tim Burton. You're not missing anything.
Yeah, so it's kind of sad. We don't seem to be hitting on anything that's like just a wow.
A lot of people think Birth of a Nation is wow. You got to go see it.
Yeah,
if you had to tell people, so there's two major wide releases this weekend: Birth of a Nation, Girl on the Train. You can only say you can go to one. Which one you tell them to go to?
If they're just looking for an escape at the movies, I would send them to The Girl on the Train. And if you like The Girl on the Train, then I'd wait a week and wait for The Assassins.
The accountant.
Oh my gosh, you're right. Sorry.
See? You're the one who's seen that already.
Oh my gosh, yes. It's called The Accountant. And I would just say, hold off for a week and wait for that one.
Well, I'm going to disagree. I'm going to say go see Birth of a Nation. You'll walk out with a bit more of an adrenaline pulse. Girl on the Train might stunt your conversation later on at the bar.
Any wagers, though, on which will do better at the box office?
Well, there's some people that are boycotting Birth of a Nation and, like, protesting outside of theaters. And everybody read the book. I guess Girl on a Train?
I think so.
I have no idea. I guess Girl on a Train.
I would go for the Girl on the Train.
Watch it be middle school.
If it's middle school, then we're both in trouble. But I wouldn't be surprised because maybe that one will sneak in there since we didn't see it.
All right. Well, the Oscar wannabes are creeping into theaters. Thank you very much for listening to, looks like it's going to be round one for Oscar wannabes. And hope you have a good week.
Ciao.
Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah is presented twice each weekend on RadioSt.Pete.com at 5:15 Eastern on Saturday and 9:15 on Sunday mornings. Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. Listen again for Cinema Clash on RadioSt.Pete.com.